Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Chris Rose. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning, Mike. Nice to be here.
And you're coming up to an anniversary and an event, and it's been a long time that many listeners have observed an organization called REAP.
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 Right.
And just for those few that might be out there that have not understood REAP or heard of it, what is REAP?
Well, REAP is a statewide nonprofit coalition of over 80 organizations promoting renewable energy and energy efficiency. So we have electric utilities. MEA is a member, for instance. We have independent power producers. We have environmental groups. We have developers, other non-governmental organizations, a lot of state and federal agencies who sit at our table as well. And we've been around since 2004 working to promote renewable energy and energy efficiency.
Okay, so you've got a lot of people. You must have a big table for them all to gather around. Or how does that that all focus and make the things happen?
Well, we have a 21-member board
that
is elected from that membership. There are seats for businesses, for utilities, for educational institutions, and then there are three large seats. And we also have a lot of committees. So we have a policy committee that works really hard throughout the year to talk about the different kinds of things that the total organization might work on.
Okay, and what's your official title?
I'm the executive director.
Okay.
I'm the founder, so I've been doing this for a while now, about 15 years.
All right. Okay, and there's something new coming. You have an event coming up fairly soon.
We have an event in Palmer. We haven't had one here in a while. On Thursday night, October 19th, at the Palmer Depot downtown from 5 to 7:30, REAP is going to have a community gathering / fundraiser, and I'll give a presentation around 6 o'clock on some of the things we're working on.
Oh, okay. As you look back over those 15 years, what would you cite as your personal most memorable or useful achievement?
Well, I think getting the Renewable Energy Fund passed in 2008 was a pretty big deal, given that we were the ones who had the idea, came up with it, got the bill through the legislature over the course of 2 years. That bill ultimately resulted in $259 million in state appropriations for renewable energy, which leveraged about another $140 million. And what that has done is put Alaska at the forefront worldwide on small microgrids. A lot of that money went to rural Alaska, where communities are not connected by road or transmission line. And so what we're able to do is put renewables on top of a diesel backbone.
Okay.
And there are people around the world now trying to figure out how to do that and asking Alaska for help.
Well, I made two trips fairly recently. One was to Kotzebue. I was up there about 6 weeks ago. And I was very much interested in looking at Kotzebue because as we went out down the shore, the beach to a fish camp, went over a hill where there were some pretty tall windmills up there. And so I had a chance to talk to a few people about how they were working with that. And I guess I was impressed. I hadn't been to Kotzebue in a while. And what I've noticed is that when I haven't been to a place in a while and I arrive, I see signs, whether it's a solar array or a windmill of some sort, wind generating, that there are signs of this. This is the most obvious sign. But of course, beneath that is the infrastructure of what does that actually do in terms of offsetting production of power by diesel generators, et cetera.
Well, Kotzebue has really been the pioneer in wind turbines here in Alaska. They put their first wind turbine in there in 1997. So it's been 20 years, and they have gradually added other turbines. They started out with smaller 50-kilowatt turbines, moved up to the 100-kilowatt turbines that a lot of communities are using. And the tall ones you saw are Dutch 900 EWT, so 900 kilowatts, almost a megawatt turbine. Kotzebue, because of their experience in controlling wind with their diesel system, is also now leading the way with storage, with batteries, as well as with solar. They're putting in some solar and batteries. So they'll be able to use that complete system. It's a hybrid system, so the diesel is still the backbone. And I don't want to quote the number, but I know it's in the millions of gallons of diesel that they are displacing.
Wow. Well, that's got to be a big deal.
Yeah, I think it's over a million.
Now, again, it's been in the news almost as much as you. Elon Musk has been reported to nearing completion on the biggest Lyon battery in the world in South Australia, which was apparently an attempt to be able. And he's also been interestingly in the news because of the placement offer of hundreds of batteries to Puerto Rico, as in a way as an effort to deal with some storage of different than we have been doing. Before. I'm just curious, do you have any comments about those kinds of things?
Well, I don't think Tesla's battery technology is that much different than other people's technology, but Elon Musk's approach to mass production is. And so just like anything else, when you get a large economy of scale going, the price comes down. And with lithium ion batteries, the price has come down tremendously just over the last 6 or 7 years, as has solar photovoltaic. So when you start seeing so many people around the world doing it, the demand increases, and the people like Elon Musk jump in there. And, you know, the big factory that he's building right now in Nevada is, I think, one of the largest buildings, if not the largest building in the world. He wants to build 50 of those around the world. And so if he is able to consummate that vision, he will bring the price of batteries down to the point where everyone will be using them.
Okay. Another observation I made in another place that was recently, drove through New Hampshire and Vermont, and I was struck. Vermont is a very rural place, and you go down the highway miles and miles, but I began to see farms, typically, and I remember them from other times I've been there, except these farms were different. There were solar panel farms, and some of them had sheep grazing to keep the grass down around them, et cetera. But I'm talking about, I can't even count the number that I saw. And each one of these generally was pretty large. There may be, the small ones had a few hundred panels. The larger ones seemed to be more than that. But they were in almost on every hillside and every place, et cetera. And so I noticed I brought back a paper from an article about a small town in southern Vermont. It was a report of the way in which the local authority, the city council, et cetera, was working out how to place these panels. Mm-hmm. And apparently in Vermont, there's been a very, both from the state level as well as locally, a process set up so that it's possible if someone wants to bring in either as an entrepreneur, more of these are larger scale, not individual installations, but they've got that. So they actually, because of the tie-in requirements and all the rest, they had worked it out. So it was nice to see that they made five propositions, four of them passed unanimously. One was going to be passed with a caveat, but I'm wondering. I'm just bouncing off that to say, in the state of Alaska, if a community, say Palmer, were interested in developing a renewable resource in some way, as on a larger scale than individually, how would that happen?
Well, probably would happen in conjunction with the utility. And I know the Manitoba Electric Association has bounced on the idea of community solar, which would be a larger solar array that people could buy a share of.
Right.
So I think that's how a community that doesn't own its own utility would do that. Now, there are a lot of municipal utilities in the lower 48. There's a lot of co-ops in the lower 48.
Right.
That may have a different kind of way to do a project themselves. But I guess the best way for people who want to see more renewable energy to do that today in the Palmer Wasilla area is go to the Matanuska Electric Association. We're all members.
Right.
And tell them what you think.
So we started, okay, that's a good point. And we started by talking about a rather remote place, Kotzebue, so on, with a small utility of some sort that's producing power there. So it feels like it would be easier if you were in a remote situation like that off the main grid to make this kind of thing happen.
Well, that's not the case in most of the world, actually. Most of the world has energy policy that is promoting renewable energy, including many, many states. There are more than 30 states now that require a certain percentage of electricity be from renewable energy by a certain date. And most European countries now have those goals. Hawaii has become the first state to have a 100% mandate for renewable energy by 2045. So that means all electrons produced in Hawaii by 2045, which is, you know, whatever, 28 years from now, have to be from renewables, so that they are leading the way. And so really it boils down to energy policy and making sure that our policymakers know what's happening. That's true with our legislature, it's true with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Technology is changing so quickly and the price is coming down so quickly that utilities are getting caught flat-footed, not understanding what is coming at them without having, you know, some idea of how other communities are dealing with this. Alaska could have the same issue.
So you mentioned Hawaii, and there are other states, obviously, that have policies in place. Is there a movement within the Alaska legislature or administration in the direction of getting ahead of this issue?
Well, I think there are a lot of legislators who understand why renewables and efficiency are important now. We've laid that groundwork over a decade of talking with policymakers. But really, there are some fundamental logistical things that we need to work on to make sure that even a policy, if a policy were made, that they would work smoothly. For instance, right now, one of our primary objectives is to get all six of the utilities in the rail belt. That is the area known as, you know, the grid-connected area between Homer and Fairbanks, which includes the three Anchorage-serving utilities, MEA, Chugach, and MLMP. Get all of them to work in one single balancing area, meaning we're going to balance supply and demand from Homer to Fairbanks in one area with one operator. That doesn't mean that the utilities would go away as distribution utilities, or it doesn't even mean that they would go away as generation utilities. What it would mean is that we would be balancing electrons in the entire region instead of six suboptimal service districts. And the reason why that's important is, first of all, consumers would win.
Right.
The studies that I've seen, and of course, there's always competing studies, but I think there's general agreement among the six utilities that that would save consumers at least $10 million a year. That means, for instance, over the last 20 years, we've wasted $200 million, okay, because of the inefficiency of having six utilities operating a relatively small amount of load. For renewables, what it would mean is we would have more places to put intermittent electrons from things like wind and solar.
Okay.
For instance, right now there's an issue with the wind farm at Fire Island that Chugach Electric buys from. They buy that electricity under contract from Cook Inlet Regional Incorporated, which owns the island and built the wind farm. So they've got a power purchase agreement. But on average, about 10% of all the wind that could have been produced from Fire Island doesn't get produced because Chugach can't take it at that one moment in time when the electron is being produced.
Right.
However, if you had a larger balancing area, if you had a larger area that everybody could take those electrons from, then, of course, you wouldn't have to curtail that and essentially waste that wind power.
That's very interesting because, to me, there's a tendency, for example, for an individual to think about how does this affect me in terms of the pocketbook, et cetera? But also, how does it affect me if I have an interest in having solar panels? So We at our home here in downtown Palmer have solar panels. They were installed. We received a tax credit. We love it. From about March to October, we might average a dollar a month that's paid to MEA. It seems as we've run the numbers to pay for itself, given the installation, even though it was done 4 years ago with more expensive panels that have declined. But I've recently been reading and talking to people that suggest, well, that's fine in kind of a transitional period. But the reality is larger entities can put in solar panels, renewables that will be at a lower cost than you can do.
That's absolutely true. Utility scale.
Yeah.
And for with wind, I always tell people to do that. I mean, go to your local utility and say you're a supporter of wind power and ask them to do the wind power because they're going to be able to do it at a much greater economy of scale. They have professional staff to maintain them. With solar, it's a little bit different because there are no moving parts.
Right.
And so everybody who feels like they can want to put solar on the roof can do it, and the price has come down so much. And particularly in a place like, California, Arizona, I was just down there talking to utility officials and, they're kind of pulling their hair out, figuring out how to deal with how many people are putting on solar on their rooftops. Right. But it's always true that if you get, you know, a bigger economies of scale, a bigger project, then the incremental cost is going to be a little bit lower. But it kind of depends on the technology.
And it depends on the utility's willingness to do that. So I satisfy my concern by saying, okay, by putting these up right now, this is a transition period where it makes sense. It's paying for itself. It's a set and forget, no maintenance type of thing. We're happy. But as time goes on, should utilities begin to move in that direction, and there'd be much less of a reason dollar-wise for an individual, unless they happen to be remote in mm-hmm. some way off the grid.
Well, this gets back down to that question of, are utilities going to be anticipating what's going on or not? If the utilities in places like California, Arizona, Hawaii had anticipated the surge of solar from individuals, they would not be dealing with issues that they're dealing with right now. The same thing should hold true here for people in Alaska, because we do have a good solar resource 8 months a year.
Sure.
We have to anticipate it. And if the utilities don't anticipate those kinds of things, people will act on their own. Same thing with electric vehicles. People will buy electric vehicles, and that will have a impact on the system. Energy efficiency is another one. I do want to talk about that. Energy efficiency is the fastest and cheapest way for us to do anything. It's what we call our first fuel. It is a resource. And if you're wasting that resource, then you can do something about it to not waste it. That usually takes a lot less effort and money to do so. But all of those things are part of the system. And what we're asking the six utilities in the Rail Belt to do is work together so that they can anticipate those kinds of issues and have long-term planning as a region, which we have never had in the Rail Belt. We don't have long-term regional planning. We have planning amongst the six within the six utilities. We're estimating that Alaskans collectively are spending $5 billion a year on energy. That's transportation, electric, and heat. And we're also conservatively estimating we're wasting 20% of that. That means Alaskans are literally, they have a $1 billion annual bonfire. We're all throwing bills into this big bonfire. $1 billion a year. That's a huge amount of money that we're wasting that could be recirculating in our economy. So one of the biggest takeaways, I think, from what the work we're doing is that this is good for the economy to promote energy efficiency, to use local renewable energy resources means money stays in Alaska's economy in our local communities and is not exported to bring fuel in.
Okay. Mike Malevsky here, and I've been talking with Chris Rose, who's executive director of REAP. And covering a lot of ground, you mentioned electric vehicles, and I know that they're watching the numbers. It appears that nationwide and in Alaska, the number of electric vehicles or hybrid plug-in vehicles that are be using electricity in one fashion or another is growing. How soon, I mean, people who look at electric vehicles, sometimes if they're critics of the development of electric vehicles, say the impact on the grid will be catastrophic or enormous or whatever. What's your sense of that? Is the growth rate at a level that utilities can accommodate or what's going to happen?
Utilities should have no problem accommodating it. In fact, there's a nice balance between people doing more efficiency, which is reducing the load for the utilities, and buying an electric car and increasing the load. And so there's actually a nice symmetry there. And for those utilities that are concerned about people, you know, changing to LEDs and getting better appliances and so on, a lot of them are very, very much happy to see another source of customers out there.
Beautiful.
Juno Electric Light and Power, now Avista, is promoting electric cars in Juno quite a bit. There are, I think, 160 Nissan Leafs in Juno
right,
now.
Right.
So, and in Alaska, we should actually be leaders in this because we have relatively small road systems. I know the Rail Belt's an exception, but almost all the other communities around the state, you don't have any range anxiety if you've got a 40-mile road system. And so there are a lot of places in Alaska that will be using more renewable or more electric cars and hopefully in combination with renewable energy.
Right. Now, you mentioned a second thing in addition to electric vehicles, which is the efficiency issue. And I know that over the years, there had been programs to allow homeowners to have someone come in, do an energy audit. We, in fact, did that. So we've done a pretty good job with our own home. We have very low power usage in the house itself. If someone is interested in doing that now, what's the state of that kind of energy auditing?
Right. That's a very good question. And if you'd asked me what what REAP's second biggest accomplishment might have been, I would have talked about all the efficiency work that we've done. We promoted those programs that HFC and AEA have run, and over $600 million was appropriated by the legislature. And that money went to both rebates for people who had higher incomes and straight grants for people who didn't have as much money. And over 45,000 homes have been retrofitted.
Okay.
The average savings, and most of that's thermal, has been 30%. All that money's gone because it was grant money, and the state's in a budget deficit. So we're working on ways to keep the momentum going, because there's a lot of people who got into the business of being an auditor or a retrofitter, and they're kind of sitting on their thumbs now going, well, where's all the work?
Sure.
There's a lot of people who want to keep doing this, and there's at least another 100,000 homes that we could be retrofitting. We have done a couple of things. Just this past spring, we saw a bill pass the legislature that we wanted to see happen, called Property Assessed Clean Energy. It's a PACE program. Other states have PACE programs. Without getting into all the details, it now allows municipalities, and this would include the tax assessment authority of the Mat-Su Borough, to loan money to commercial buildings to do retrofits and then allow the building owner to pay it back through a special tax assessment. So if I owned a commercial building here in downtown Palmer, I could borrow money from the local tax property tax assessor and then pay it back through a special voluntary tax assessment. That program has been very successful in other states. More broadly, what we want to do is create a state green bank. And that is a quasi-governmental entity that uses a very limited amount of state money to buy down the risk for private banks to come in and start loaning money to people to do this.
Uh-huh.
This stuff pays for itself. You can get a cash flow positive loan to do an energy retrofit on your building or your home very easily. If you do the numbers, you can easily structure a loan so that you're saving more every month than you're paying out to pay the loan back. And so there's no reason why we shouldn't be doing those kinds of loans, except that nobody's doing them. And the private banks don't have the experience in this field to feel like the risk is low. So what a green bank does is work with the private banking institutions to show them that the risk is not nearly what they think it is. And also, if there is still some kind of perceived risk, to buy it down through a loan loss reserve fund or a loan guarantee that the state puts the money up for. We're getting some traction on this. We're working with a Connecticut Green Bank right now, which is deemed to be the most successful green bank in the country. They have financed $1 billion worth of clean energy in the last 5 years since they were established. And they're doing it almost all with private money. Mm-hmm. So these are not grants. This is generating a ton of jobs. This is generating a ton of economic activity. And the ultimate result is you get more renewable energy and more energy efficiency and more money staying in the economy.
So given the present state of the legislature's focus, the number of issues, the budget deficit, and you've been working at this for some time, how do you think in the next session or two you'll be able to get traction on the idea that if you spend a little, you can save a lot and everybody wins?
We're getting traction, and there's no doubt. I've talked to legislators about this idea. I didn't get any pushback.
Okay.
But, you know, I think the saying that there's an elephant in the room or a gorilla in the room, I mean, the deficit is so big, such a big problem, that I almost feel like I just want them to focus on that, because if they don't get
do that.
That,
got it.
It's very difficult for us to talk about all these other ideas that we have to move forward in the state, or else we're going to get left behind.
Sure.
I mean, that's kind of the message in a lot of this stuff, is we can not do it at our own peril. The rest of the world is moving forward. And if we want to be competitive, even with other states, we have to do a lot of this stuff. And clearly, our revenue structure has to change. We have to deal with the deficit. We have the tools to do it. We just have to do it. And once that's done, then we can move on to other issues.
Okay. Well, Chris Rose, we've been talking about a lot of stuff. We've come almost to the end of the time we have allotted. Any last things you'd like to do before or say before we finish up?
Well, I just want to remind folks that we are having an event here in Palmer on Thursday night, October 19th, at the Palmer Depot right downtown along the railroad tracks there, the main drag. That'll go from 5 to 7:30. We'll have some food and drinks for folks, and we'll have a little presentation around 6 o'clock. So we welcome anybody from the Valley to come join us on Thursday night, the 19th, 5 o'clock at the Depot.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris Rose, Executive Director of REAP, for coming in and walking us through a very interesting landscape.
Well, thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.